Here. So yes, I'd like to tell you about what we've been doing with spinforms over the last past years. So first, spinforms, it's about quantum gravity. And then spinforms, it's rather a technical subject, but I'll try to be very non-technical today. But then for the rest of the afternoon, after the talk, you can actually ask me any technical question you like. So spinforms, it's basically a mixture of three main ingredients. The first thing, it's state submodels for topological BF theories. So you're going to hear a lot about BF theory in this talk. So BF theory is just a gauge theory, which is topological. So meaning that there's no local degrees of freedom. And since there's no local degrees of freedom, you can always discretize the theory and it will give an exact quantization of the theory. So for an example, it's for 3D gravity, it is exactly a topological BF theory and you can quantize it exactly, and that's called the Poisson Regi mode. Then the second ingredient, it's Regi calculus, which is just general relativity on a lattice. So it's just so you can see spin forms as some quantized version of that. And then the third ingredient, it's loop quantum gravity. And you can see actually spin forms as histories of spin networks. So spin network states are the states of loop gravity. So I'm sure you've heard about that. It's basically graphs with some labels on it, which represent areas and volume. And then you've got these graphs, which evolve in time, or you want to see them evolve in what you would call time. And so the edges are going to become surfaces, and then, so you call that some kind of sum of the surfaces formalism. And then these surfaces are going to create little bubbles, and space-time is going to be made of these little bubbles, and that's why you call it spin foam, because it's little bubbles of spin. So I've told you where spin foams come from, and so what actually are spin foams? So spin forms, it's a framework for regularized non-perturbative path integral for quantum gravity. So what's the general recipe to make these spin form models? As I said, you start with BF theory, because these are topological gauge theories. You know how to quantize them. They're nice and everything. And you write GR as a BF theory plus some little extra potential, which is going to introduce degrees of freedom, the right degrees of freedom, which is the graviton and so on. And then you're going to discretize the path integral for such a theory, the field theory. So you're going to start by the discretization of a BF theory, which you know how it works. Then you're going to try to include this potential little by little. So you're going to discretize that path integral on a triangulation of a four-dimensional space-time manifold. And then, so what do you do with that? So there's many different spin form models, because we don't know quantum gravity yet, so we're just giving models of quantum gravity for the moment. So a spin form model is a certain choice of amplitude for each triangulation of space-time. And these amplitudes are defined as some product of some local terms. So the triangulation is going to be made of little block of space-time, and you're going to have amplitudes for each of them, and the total amplitude is going to be the product of these. Then you can look at what's happening on the boundaries of that, and the boundaries are going to be three-dimensional triangulation, so triangulation of space. And you can actually make the link with loop quantum gravity by saying that these three-dimensional space triangulations are dual to spin network state. And therefore, your spin form amplitudes, which are the amplitudes for space-time, are going to define transition amplitudes between spin network states. So basically, we're going to ascribe a probability amplitude to each history of spin networks. So now you know everything about spin forms. So actually, what's the mathematics in there? So we started with that BF theory. That BF theory is a gauge theory. So we start with taking a gauge group G. Usually, we work with SU2 because it's the simplest case. Or usually also the Lorentz group. If there's other more complicated ways of rewriting general relativity as a BF theory, we will use the relevant gauge group. So as I said, we're going to take space-time triangulations. So space-time triangulations are made basically of triangles, tetrahedron, and four simplices. So four simplices are the basic building blocks of the space-time triangulations. It's the simplest four-dimensional object, which is made of 5 points in space-time, and you link these 5 points like that. So imagine this in four dimensions. And so this kind of four simplex is made of like 5 points, 10 edges, 10 triangles, 5 tetrahedron. That's going to be the main object in the spin form models. So the recipe is that to every triangle, you associate representation of your gauge group. So in the case of SU2, it spins. So I wrote them J, T. To every tetrahedron is made of four triangles. And you're going to associate them intertwiners between the four triangles. So intertwiners, it's invariant tensors between the four representations. Or you can see them as singlet state in the case of SU2. So states which are, well, yeah, invariant of the SU2 in the tensor product of these representations. So, and then you can see the four simplex as made as a construction of its five tetrahedron. And basically this little diagram that I draw, you can see it as a four simplex, so you can see it also as its associated boundary spin network. Okay, but these are just words, but basically the representation that you choose is the quantization of a triangle. The intertwiner is a represent a quantum tetrahedron, and this boundary spin network represents the quantum four simplex. And then you're going to make space-time by gluing these quantum four simplexes together. And then you're going to write an amplitude for these triangulations, which is just a sum of all possible labels of a product of terms associated to triangles, tetrahedron, and four simplices. So basically, the things which are associated to triangles and tetrahedron, you can see them are just measure terms in the path integral. And all the dynamics is contained in the four-dimensional pieces, meaning in the four simplices. So here, that's a kind of drawing of what's happening. So these things represent four simplices with the five tetrahedrons which are glued together. That's another four simplex. And you're going to glue these four simplices along tetrahedron. Oh, that's the best I could find. So what are the different spin four models which are in the literature these days? So the oldest one is the Ponsonby Ranger model, which actually was written in 1968, so a long time ago, but it was not called spinform at that time. So the Ponsonby Ranger model is a spinform model for 3D gravity. It uses in the Euclidean version the group SU2, or in the Lorentzian version the group SU11. So you can basically see it exactly as a discretization of BF theory in three space-time dimensions. The amplitude for three simplices, so tetrahedron, is the suggest symbol, which is an SU2 invariant, an invariant of a representation theory of SU2. So basically, for the Ponsonby Ranger model, you're going to make the three-dimensional space-time by gluing tetrahedrons together, and you're going to make the spin-form amplitude by gluing suggest symbols together. When you can see it, it's related to Ricci calculus, because the suggest symbol for large spins is the cosine of a Ricci action. And then you could even put some cosmological constant in it, and it corresponds to Q deforming the gauge group, so going to UQ of SU2. So that's in 3D. In 4D, the different models that exist, it's basically the quantization of BF theory. So for example, in the case of SU2, in that case, the four simplices correspond to some other invariant of the SU2 representation theory, which is the 15-inch symbol. And just the important thing to remember about theory is that it's non-geometric because it's not gravity. It's just topological, doesn't have any degrees of freedom. So then there's the first models for quantum gravity. So the oldest one is the Barrett-Crane model, which was in 1998. It's basically writing general relativity as a constrained BF theory, and it uses the Lorentz group. So spin 4 in the Euclidean case, or spin 3-1 in the Lorentzian case. And it's based on quantizing single four simplices. So you can see the four simplexes as a geometric object, and you quantize it, some geometric quantization scheme. And from there, you find some amplitude that you call the 10J symbol. Basically, in the 10J, it depends on 10 representations, so 10 spins. Each spin corresponds to the 10 triangles of the four simplex. If you remember that they said the four simplex is made of 10 triangles. The important features of this model is that there's no dynamics for intertwiners. Basically, in some sense, the tetrahedrons are frozen. So there's some space-time dynamics, but there's nothing happening on the space slices. Then the cool thing still about that model, which made the reason why we studied it, is that it's related to rigid calculus. So you can actually look at this four simplex amplitude in the large scale limit, and it's going to be related to the cosine of a rigid action again. So that makes you happy. But actually, there's lots of bad terms also in that asymptotics. And these bad terms are much larger than the cosine of a rigid action, so you're not very happy about that. But then later, I will tell you how you get rid of these bad terms. And then there's new models, which are models by Engel, Pereira, Rovelli, and Friedel, and Krasnov. Well, Laurent, who is here. And it's once again uses the gauge groups, the Lorentz group. It uses some coherent intertwiners, so some states for the tetrahedron. Now, the tetrahedra are not frozen, so you can have some freedom, some dynamics in the space slices. And then you have a much better asymptotics. So I didn't write the symbol. It's not the tangy, some generalization of it. It has a similar expansion, but it's better. And then there's some last type of spinform models, which are actually based on the McDowell-Mansouri reformulation for GR and use the Disitter group, so spin 5 or spin 4-1. And actually, it's a very cool approach, but nobody really wrote the spinform model for it. But it's a cool thing. That's why I've put it there. So actually, what did we do with all that? So I've just shown you what are spinforms, a bit roughly. And so that's some models for quantum gravity. And I mean, once we've got the model, you've got to do something with it. So we did a few things. Well, we tried to get some numbers out of it. And the first thing, since it's gravity, you could try to get some correlations for the gravitons. So what we call the graviton propagator. And the goal is to recover the standard perturbation theory of general relativity with hopefully some improvements, because usually it's diverged, but here you're thinking you're doing quantum gravity, so it should be better. Then there's some more mathematical result, which is concerned these coherent intertwiners. So it's been a very important tool for us to study the large scale limits of a semi-classical approximation to spin forms, and actually in constructing these new EPR, FK spinform models that I mentioned in the previous slide. Then some even more important result concerning the coupling of matter to spinforms. And so the goal here is that you put matter in the spinform, so matter coupled to quantum gravity, and you try to see how the matter is going to, you're going to take into account the feedback of the fluctuating geometry in the propagation of matter. And then you see that somehow you manage to derive some non-commutative field theories which describe the effective dynamics of these matter fields coupled to the quantum geometry. And these non-commutative field theories are similar to these doubly special relativity theories that I'm sure you heard about, which are based on some deformed Poincaré symmetries. And since it's some deformation of a Poincaré symmetry, you're going to have some experimental signature of these theories in dispersion, modified dispersion relation, and hopefully lots of other experimental signatures. So that's a cool step towards getting some experimental prediction for spin forms. Then the last point, which is actually the ones I will insist the most today, it's group field theory. So basically, this is, it's a non-perturbative reformulation of spin form. So as I said earlier, usually the spin form, it's an amplitude for each triangulation. And now what you'd like to do, it's actually sum over all these triangulations. And the way to do that is you can write all these spin form amplitudes as Feynman diagrams of one non-perturbative object, which is this group field theories. So I will explain that later in more details. So that's the main results that I see.
When you say unperturbative, you don't mean it as in before you were perturbing around a background or something like that, do you? It's like a...
I actually mean that we were...
The spinform models, before you did this non-perturbative thing...
Well, before you could see it like there's nothing, mm-hmm. then there's one force simplex, then there's two force simplex, then there's...
Yeah, okay. One force simplex isn't a flat practice. I mean, when you say perturbative, no, usually in the context of quantum gravity, you meant you're meaning, you know, linear
perturbation. Well, here I mean perturbative around nothing.
Around nothing.
About the zero metric. And now you can do it
non-perturbatively.
Okay. What is nothing?
Zero metric. Well, it's not a metric anymore, but the nothing thing.
So I mean, these are the main results that I see. I chose them because it's the stuff I worked on, but there's all the results that we're getting. It's, for example, there's been a lot of work on the relation between spin forms and quantum Rege calculus, especially because it's a special type of Rege calculus where the basic variables are areas and not the length. There's been a lot of work on relating the spin forms to the canonical loop quantum gravity framework. Because, of course, as I said in the first slide, you can see spin forms as histories of spin networks, but it doesn't always fit exactly. So we try to make it fit, and we managed to make it fit. There have been spin form models which were written for supergravity and also for BF coupled to strings. And, well, there was other things too, like understanding more about the relation between gravity and BF theory. And I'm sure I've forgotten other things. So I will just tell you about these main results. Hopefully it's interesting. So the first thing I mentioned was the graviton propagator. So it was a proposal by Carlo Rovelli a few years ago. And the idea is to compute correlations between the basic variables of your theory in the spin four models. So computing correlation between areas in the spin four models. And since you've got some kind of two-point function, you can actually see it as kind of computing the graviton propagator for GR, for general relativity. So this proposal actually consisted in made the first real test for spin-form models. Since we have different spin-form models, different amplitudes, then we can compute these correlations and see if they behave as expected. And since this proposal, we've been quite a lot of working on that, trying to get to understand how it works and to get numbers on it. And this actually, this kind of work is related to understanding the asymptotics of these spin form amplitudes like the 10J and 15J that I mentioned earlier. So there have been a lot of analytical and numerical work on that. So the general setting of this graviton propagator is that, so you're going to take a space-time triangulation, you're going to put some boundary on it, and then you're going to choose a spin-form model, and you want to put a nice semi-classical state on the boundary. So something which is going to represent, for example, some flat 3D space. And then you're going to choose two triangles on this boundary, and you're going to check the correlations between these two areas, depending on the dynamics for the bulk triangulation. So basically what you do is that these are your two observables related to the two triangles that you chose. And you're going to sum on all the possible labels inside, so all the possible geometry of the bulk of these two observables, your boundary state, and then the amplitude of your bulk triangulation. So when you just see that, when you think, oh, okay, when once I've got the boundary state, this is just a question of calculating. So yeah, we can just calculate these things. There's just a few subtleties on that. Is that first, usually these amplitudes are going to diverge when you sum over all the possible labels. So you have to understand the symmetries of the spin-form model and to gauge fix it. And then what you would like is sum over all possible really geometries inside. So not a fixed triangulation, but sum over all possible four-dimensional triangulation compatible with your boundary structure, which you fixed. And once you've done that, then you would get some two-point function which actually correspond to the graviton propagator of quantum gravity. So that was the general setting. So it's what we'd like to do. Now, actually, we can't do it exactly. So instead of taking any triangulations, we actually take the simplest triangulation, so a four simplex. It's a very, very simple space-time. We believe in it. So then this four simplex is made of 10 triangles, but you take two triangles and you take as observable what the SU2 Casimir, which actually represents the area of your triangle. And then I said you must choose a spin form model. So we mainly studied the Barrett-Crane model or even the Ponzano LJ model in 3D because it's actually simpler and because there's no intertwiners in there. So it's more a toy model to see how things work and what you're able to do. And then we'd like to do that on more realistic model like the new EPR-FK models or even better models than these ones. So as I said, you take these two observables, you compute the two-point functions. So you insert your observables, you insert your boundary state, and your spin form amplitude, which was the tangent symbol. So then you have to choose your boundary state. And so, as I said earlier, you need some semi-classical boundary state. So something which is going to be picked on some classical geometry for the four simplex. So if it's semi-classical, as usual, you're going to take some kind of wave Gaussian wave packet. So this kind of thing, which is basically you take every areas of your triangles on your four simplex and you pick them on some value. And then this term is actually the dual term, which means that you're going to fix the dihedral angles between triangles to its classical value. So in that sense, you take this kind of ansatz and it represents some kind of flat equilateral four simplex. You can, of course, make it non-equilateral and everything, but you're just making it more complicated for not much more. Then I said a semi-classical state. Then you need this state to be physical, meaning it must satisfy the constraint of general relativity. And when you do that, you actually see that it fixes the width of your Gaussian packet. So it works in 3D, and I didn't put that it actually works in four dimensions too. So it always works. And then, so the natural questions when you fix this framework, it's can you do something with more complicated triangulations? And that's related to the question of being able to renormalize these spin form amplitudes, coarse grain them. It's a complicated question. And also the question of actually using a better spin form models. So something where you have some dynamics for intertwiners, and for example, using these EPR-FK spin form models. So this is the setting. So we actually made calculations and we get results on that. So we can do both analytical and numerical results in 3D and 4D. And so the main thing that you, that's a diagram of this calculation in 3D and that's in four dimensions. So the main thing is that in the asymptotics, it's a log-log plot. So this is the correlation in terms of that length scale J0 that I've put in my boundary state. And so you see something which decreases in actually in 1 over J0 in the large scale. So remember that J0 is the area, so it's that your two-point function decreases in 1 over the length squared, so which is the right scaling for field theories and in particular for Newton's law, yes.
Gravity, where there isn't any. Did you say something about it being 3D?
Well, in 3D, it's just pure gauge, but it still works. In 4D, it's real, but it's the Barrett-Crane model, so it's not. We don't know if it's gravity, but it works. And then what you can see in the case of four dimensions, which is actually very interesting, is that the correlations are regularized at small scale. So meaning they're not going to diverge, but they kind of like converge. And you see some kind of like bump there, which corresponds to some dynamically generated minimal scale. So that's the cool stuff. So you get some kind of regularized graviton propagator, which behaves nicely at the semi-classical limit. And then what we can do also, that's the first order, we can actually compute quantum corrections on that. So compute the first order, the second order. We didn't go further, but we have the techniques to compute it any order we want, if you actually wanted to. And we can see the dependence on the measure terms in the path integral and all that. So once you've seen all that, the main question is like to find the right spin form model and to do it with this one. Yes?
Newton's law is that G is big GM over R squared. So how do you deduce big G times M? Because you...
No, it's not there. I'm just saying it's the right scaling. Hmm? I'm just saying it's the right scaling.
It goes like 1 over R squared.
Yes, yeah.
But what about the gravity? G and M.
Yeah, I wish we could see it, but we didn't put really matter in there, so we can't have
it. Otherwise, I don't know how Newton's law.
Yeah, I understand.
It's a geometry.
Yeah, it's very rudimentary. But yeah, and we'll do better later. I hope so. Yeah, no, it's just an elementary result to check if things work as expected, and we need to get a more physical understanding of what's happening. So these are the results you got at the moment. It's actually related to, as I said earlier, to understanding the asymptotics of the spinform amplitudes for large scale.
And the last point about that is actually this is the right scaling, as I said. But even without going to the factors of the G and the M's and the masses, the first thing you'd like to check is whether it has the right tensorial structure for the Grothendieck propagator, so something like a spin 2. So in this case, it doesn't work for the Bartkrin model. So it's kind of something bad about the Bartkrin model. But what this gives is like some ansatz, some asymptotical ansatz that you know that should be for the spin four models amplitudes, which should correspond to quantum gravity. So this is really, it consists a test really for spin four models. You have your spin form amplitude, you check its asymptotics, you see if it fits with this ansatz. If it doesn't, you try another one. So that was for the Grothendieck propagator. Then the other thing, the second result was coherent intertwiners. So the main point here is that when you study loop quantum gravity, usually you have these intertwiners which represent your tetrahedron, I mean your space, your volumes. And the standard basis that you use, it's labeled by spins, internal spins. And it's actually not at all semi-classical state, and it's not very well when you want to study scaling or semi-classical limits. So what we did was writing some better coherent state for that. And I won't get into the details on that. But I will just say that when we use these coherent intertwiners to study all the asymptotics and actually to improve the graviton calculations and to build the new spin four models. In particular, these coherent intertwiners allow to resolve in a nice way the simplicity constraint that which are the constraints which turn BF theory in gravity, so create degrees of freedom, and to resolve this problem with the Bartkrin model, as I said, that there's no dynamics of space, there's no dynamics of intertwiners. So actually this tool help understanding the relation between spin forms and loop quantum gravity. But if you want details, I can give them to you later. What I'd like to get to is something a bit more technical. It's about the coupling of matter to spin forms. So I will start in three dimensions because actually it works much better in three dimensions. So in three dimensions, as I said, we're working with a Ponzano-Regier model, which is a quantization of pure BF theory. So BF theory, it has this simple action. It's a theory which depends on two variables, A, which is a connection, an SU2 connection, and B, which is a Lagrange multiplier, imposing that the curvature is flat. So it's a very simple theory, just saying it's a flat connection theory. So it's what I wrote here. And then what you do is that you discretize it. So you're going to consider the holonomies of your connections. So basically, parallel transport on around loops. And you're going to impose that all of these loops are constrained to be the identity. So no curvature, trivial holonomies. So when you look at this object, you can actually use some representation of SU2. And you can actually explicitly show that this kind of integral, this partial function, it's really the Ponzano-Regier model, which is expressed as a product of the Seguin symbols on all tetrahedron. Okay, so that's 3D quantum gravity as a BF theory. Then you'd like to put matter in there. So matter are going to be simply topological defects in 3D. So instead of having trivial holonomies, your particle is going to make a hole, make a conical singularity, and you're going to have a non-trivial holonomy around it. So basically, instead of having an angle around your particle which is 2 pi, you're going to have some deficit angle which is related to the mass over the Planck mass. So basically, it's what I wrote here, that if you want some on-shell particle, you constrain the holonomy not to be the identity, but to have some non-trivial angle. Or then, if it's an off-shell particle in general, like in Feynman diagrams, instead of really constraining your particle to have a definite mass, you insert this kind of propagator. So this represents the mass, right, because the angle is related to the mass. And this is some functions of your group element, which is basically some parameterization of SU2, a coordinate system on SU2. And then you put these conditions, you insert them in your Poisson function. So here, instead of having a delta of the holonomies, you're going to have some, you're going to insert that propagator there to take in account the history, when the particles propagating through your spin forms. And you can actually also do the, decompose that into SU2 representation, and you can actually write it. It's some very simple things, some insertions of some terms like that along the edges of your triangulation where you've put particles. Any question on here? No? Okay. So the big results that we got a few years ago with Laurent is that if you take these spinform amplitudes for geometry plus these off-shell particles, then you can show it's exactly some evaluation of some Feynman diagram, some non-commutative field theory. So these are your spinform amplitude, and it's equal to these Feynman diagrams of this kind of theory. So here, I mean, my field is phi. This is the propagator I've put, and these are the interaction terms. So actually, what is this kind of theory? Why do I call that a non-commutative quantum field theory? Is that here, actually, this is the momentum representations. So, I mean, that's why you've got P squared and not a Laplacian. And you see that your momentum space is not flat. It's not R-free. It's SU2. And SU2 is curved. And by duality, if your momentum space is curved, your coordinate space, which is dual to it, is going to be non-commutative. Because you are going to reconstruct your coordinates as derivative on your momentum space, and so it becomes all non-commutative. A second implication of that is that since it's SU2, it's compact, so your momentum space is somehow bounded, it's compact, and that's going to create a minimal length, which goes in one over the mass, the Planck mass. And the last important point is that here, you see that constraint here, which means that if I insert different momenta in my interaction, so the momenta G1, G2, to Gn, this is just the constraint which corresponds to that the sum of a momenta is zero. So this is conservation of momenta. Yes?
If you express broadly a quantum field theory as a Minkowski standard product formulas, then it's non-local. This must be normal.
Indeed. Yeah, it's going to be expressed. I'll just say that here. Oh. Yeah, so as I said, well, this might be a bit technical, actually. But what I said is that you've got your momentum space, SU2, and you can reconstruct the dual coordinate space R3 through some kind of Fourier transform on the SU2 manifold. And through this Fourier transform, you can define a star product in the coordinate space. So instead of having the normal commutative product between functions on your space, you're going to have some non-commutative product. So these are the plane waves I've written, and some non-commutative product, which is dual to the product on SU2. So, and as it was pointed out, this star product is going to be non-local, actually. So if you do the product of two functions, two fields on one point, is going to depend on the fields everywhere. But it's some non-locality, which is goes in one over the Planck mass. So for example, you can see the delta distribution on that space. So instead of being peaked, it's actually regularized, and you can write it in terms of a Bessel function. So this thing where you see that basically the characteristic length is one over the Planck mass. What you've done with Fourier transform and all, you can do the Fourier transform of your field theory that I wrote here, puff, you do it, clack, and you write it in terms of that Fourier transform in coordinate space as the Laplacian that comes. And here I forgot a star product in there. And so it really looks like unusual field theory, except that it has a star product everywhere, so it's non-commutative.
But if you take the limit where kappa goes to infinity, it will come back to something, to the usual commutative field theory. So what's important about this non-commutative field theory is that first, it describes the effective dynamics of the matter coupled to quantum gravity. So we actually take in account all the fluctuation of the geometry. Well, it's 3D, so there's not so many fluctuations. We've taken in account all these effects on the propagation of matter, and it deforms my quantum field theory into a non-commutative field theory. But it's not a random non-commutativity structure. It's actually still invariant under some deformation of Poincaré, which in this case is the quantum double of SU2. So basically, you're going to have Lorentz transformations which act on your field. So here it's the momenta, and I've written everything in momentum space. So these Lorentz transformations, they're going to act simply by rotating my momentum. And the translation are going to act as usual by action of by multiplicating my field by a plane wave. So when you see that, when you don't see really that it's deformed, it just looks like something normal, like the usual action of Poincaré, Lorentz, translations, everything is fine. The only thing is that now it has a non-trivial co-product. So what does it mean? It means that the translations are not going to act on tensor product of a field as you would expect them to. So it's actually what I wrote here. If I do a translations on a pair of fields, so two particles somehow, if it was normal, I would get one plane wave for the first one and one plane wave for the other one. Instead of that, I get the star product of these two plane waves. And here you see that if you remember, I said that this is a momentum representation, so these group elements of SU2 are the momentum, G1 and G2. And you interpret that as the momenta, then you can see that you're going to get some modified action of modified addition of momenta, which is actually non-commutative. I mean, I didn't tell you the exact definition of the momentum that I chose, which is basically the projection of your group element on the Pauli matrices. But the important thing is that this modified action of momenta, whatever coordinate you choose, simply reflects the group multiplication on SU2. Since the group multiplication on SU2 is non-commutative, then you've got a non-commutative addition of momenta. It's also a braided theory. So meaning if I exchange two particles, it's not simply exchanging the momenta, but you're going to have a non-trivial feedback of the first particle on the second particle. So this is in three dimensions. So what you'd like is do that in four dimensions and see how it goes. Can we do the same? Can you get some non-commutative field theory and everything? So first, we do not really have a spin form model for quantum gravity in four dimensions. We have tentative models, but we do not have a real one yet. Also, particles are not really topological defects in four dimensions. I mean, if you put some particle, it's not going to deform the whole geometry to infinity. It's going to be flat at some point. So, yeah. But still, the main ingredients of what we did still are true. So there's still this correspondence between the Feynman diagrams of field theories and observables of my spin four models. So the kind of equality that I wrote here, which is the main ingredient, is still true. Then you can still see non-commutative field theories in momentum space as theories on a curved group manifold, which represent the momentum space. And then after all, particles are actually almost topological defects if you take in the point of view of BF theory. So since we're going to write GR, general relativity, as BF theory plus some hopefully small thing, should almost work. And what I'm going to say is that you can actually make all this work using group field theories. And using these group field theories, we'll be able to derive these models of doubly special relativity with deformed Poincaré group from these four-dimensional spin-four models. So meaning that we really get some non-commutative field theories, some some prediction of some modified dispersion relation and all that. So it would really give you an experimental signature of spin forms. Of course, it all relies on the fact that you are able to understand these non-commutative field theories. So as I said, it all depends on these group fit theory techniques. So that's what I'm going to tell you about now. So group fit theories. So it's some kind of reformulation, complete reformulation of spin forms. So up to now, you had your spin form amplitude for each triangulations of space-time. Now what you're going to do is that you're going to write a theory that when you look at its Feynman diagrams, each Feynman diagram is going to be a four-dimensional triangulation. And the evaluation of that Feynman diagram is going to be the spin form amplitude for that triangulation. And then what you can do is that you can then implement your sum of all possible four-dimensional triangulations using this path integral for this generating field theory. So more explicitly, how it works. You look for matrix models, which are used in 2D gravity. And these matrix models actually generate two-dimensional triangulations. So you take your square matrix, any size, and you consider this type of action. So a trivial propagator, a quadratic trace of the matrix squared, and so for example, a cubic interaction. When you're going to look at its Feynman diagrams, you're going to see that this is something, some trivalent vertex like that. And you're going to glue these trivalent vertices, which you can see as triangles, because they're trivalent. You're going to glue them trivially using this propagator. So you see that the Feynman diagrams are just going to be obtained by gluing these triangles together. You can't really see it with my fingers, but it really works. These Feynman diagrams are going to be two-dimensional triangulations. So the Feynman diagrams of these matrix models are going to generate all two-dimensional triangulations, so all two-dimensional triangulated manifold surfaces. In that case, the spin form amplitudes, the amplitudes of these Feynman diagrams are trivial. They are just this coupling constant to the number of triangles. But for spin form models, you're going to make it become non-trivial. So what you do in general, so that's two dimensions. What you'd like to do for any dimension, which I called n, is that you're going to do the same thing. The interaction term of your group field theory is going to represent an n-dimensional simplex. Then you're going to take a propagator, which is going to tell you how you glue these n-simplices together. And then you're going to see that these Feynman diagrams, which are obtained by gluing all these n-simplices together, is actually going to give you triangulations. Well, actually, it's pseudo-triangulation because it doesn't always represent a nice manifold. But this is just a detail. And then you want, of course, that the evaluation of these Feynman diagrams gives you the relevant spin form amplitudes for the model you'd like. So once you've done all that, actually, what you have is a rigorous definition of your spin form amplitudes and a non-trivial definition of the sum of the triangulations. So I'll just tell you how it works step by step. So you start with 2D group field theories, which are group field theory for the BF theory for gauge group SU2. So how it works is that instead of taking a matrix, you take a field which depends on two arguments. So just like the matrix had two indices, well, you have two arguments. So it's like a matrix of infinite size. Since you want something which is a gauge theory at the SU2, you require some little invariance of your gauge field. So this field is depends on two group elements, and you want it to be invariant on the action of SU2 on these group elements. And then you take some action which totally mimics the matrix models. So some trivial propagator there. So you just glue your field with itself. And then you take some, you take a cubic term, which is just the same thing as taking the trace of your matrix cube. So basically, you can see that this field represents a segment. And then this is going to be made of three segments, making a triangle. And then you're going to glue your segments together, your triangles together along the segments. So it's exactly the same thing as the matrix model. So the little thing about that is that you can play with it a bit. First, you can see that since here you impose on some S2 invariants, and so basically it was a function of two group elements, but you kind of suppress one, so you can actually write it in some type of gauge fixed field. So as you saw, it only depends on this combination of G1, G2 minus 1 because of this gauge invariance. So you can rewrite this action like that, which actually you see more of a combinatorial structure of your action. So sometimes your field phi of G minus 1 phi G and something like that with this constraint, delta G1, G2, G3. Once you have that, I mean, we always like to decompose things in SU2 representations. So you decompose your field using the Peter-Bell theorem. And basically what you have is that you decompose your field on the matrix elements of a group element and every possible representation. Basically what it does is that you're going to have a matrix which represents the Fourier components of your field and a matrix for each representation, for each spin. Matrices which have the size of a representation. So this DG is just 2G plus 1. And then you see that this action is just some kind of sum of decoupled matrix models. So for every representation, you've got this matrix, phi G, which is the components of the field, and you've got the same action as before. So 1/2 of trace of the matrix squared minus the coupling constant times trace of the matrix cube. So although we did something like more complex, putting SU2 and all that, in two-dimensional, everything is simple. You only get matrix models. Of course, in 3D, it's going to be a bit more complicated. So now what you're going to do is that you want to write the group field theory for Ponzano-Regge, for the Ponzano-Regge model. So as I said earlier, the Ponzano-Regge model, it's still BF theory for gauge group SU2. And it's still topological. So it's basically the same thing as in 2D, except you add one dimension. So instead of having a field which represents segments, you're going to have a field which represents triangles. So now it's going to have three arguments. And you impose the same kind of invariance under SU2. And now you're going to take this more complicated action. So this is still the trivial propagator, which means that the triangles is propagated into itself. And this is a more complicated interaction terms, which I forgot to put a drawing there. But basically, each of these represent a triangle. And you glue them in a certain way so that your four triangles form a tetrahedron. And that's this constraint that you want it to form a tetrahedron, which says like which group element you should put where. But so basically, this thing represents a tetrahedron. And you're going to glue these tetrahedra together along these triangles, and so you're going to get your three-dimensional triangulations. So as I said, this interaction defines a tetrahedron, and then the Feynman diagrams of this group field theory are exactly the spin form amplitudes for SU2 BF theory, which is the Ponzano-Regge model. So maybe you can see that a bit more by, as usual, decomposing your field into representations. So now you're going to get a tensor. I mean, you're going to have one representation for each group element, so G1, G2, G3. Instead of having a matrix, you're going to have an object which has three legs. These are the matrix elements of your group elements, so these are the Fourier modes. And then here, you've got some intertwiner between your three representations. Your intertwiner is there because it's invariant to the SU2. It comes because here you require it to be invariant to the SU2. So this thing, which I call intertwiner, in that case, is just the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. So it's just normal things that you do. Basically, so you insert this into this action, and you can compute it. I didn't put the indices here because then it wouldn't fit on the page. But basically, you have this tensor, you've got a trivial propagator for it. So this tensor propagates into itself. And then you've got a combination of four of these tensors, which once again represent a tetrahedron. And you see that this Sigge symbol has appeared simply because it is the contraction of four Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. And if you remember, I said that the Ponzano-Regge model was built out of Sigge symbols, and it comes from here. And you have one Sigge symbol for each tetrahedron. And then you can play the same game in four dimensions. and you can once again add one dimensions. And so you're going to write some theory which interaction term has a combinatorial structure that represents a four simplex. I've put the kind of combinatorial structure here that you want. So you'd have a field, which is a field of four group elements, which represent a tetrahedron. So, and this is a four simplex. So you will have, in the four simplex, you have five tetrahedron. Each tetrahedron have these four triangles. And then you're going to glue this tetrahedron together along triangles. So this thing represents a four simplex. And then you're going to have a trivial propagator. So the tetrahedron propagates into a tetrahedron, which glues these four simplexes together. So you're going to glue these four simplexes together, and you're going to generate four-dimensional triangulations. So now you can write exactly the same action as here, adding one group element. And that's what you're going to call the Bulatov-Ogury group field theory, which generates SU2BF theory in four dimensions. And if you do the same game, the same game as here, and you decompose everything in the representation of SU2, you're going to get this 15J symbol for each four simplex, which, if you remember, I said that was the building block of the spin form amplitudes for topological BF theory in four dimensions. So again, here I just talked about SU2BF theory. The important thing which was proven was that you can take any spin form model and you can always write it as a group field theory with interaction term, which is actually given by the Fourier transform of your four simplex amplitude. So it's not some technique that works only with like topological BF theory, that you really take any possible amplitude that you can think of and you can always write it in this way. So in that sense, this group field theory is really a universal tool which allows a non-perturbative definition of all your spin form models. So here I talked about group field theory, but before I said I was going to do something interesting with it. So what I meant by interesting is that in three dimension, I had started by telling you about the spin form amplitudes for geometry coupled to matter. And I tell you that these were the Feynman diagrams on some non-commutative group field theory, non-commutative quantum field theory, which represented the effective dynamics of matter. So now, I just said that these spin form amplitudes are actually Feynman diagrams of some group field theory. And here, these are Feynman diagrams of this non-commutative quantum field theory. And so usually, if you have like two theories which have the same Feynman diagrams, they should be equal. So there should be a direct link between these group field theories, which are basically the non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity, and these non-commutative quantum field theories. So this works exactly in 3D, and then in 4D we can use the same intuition. So how does it work? If you remember a few slides ago, I told you that these non-commutative quantum field theories, you can write them on the momentum space using SU2. And there are these kind of theories there. So you have your field. G is the momentum. You've got something here. I've put any non-trivial propagator, kinetic term, K. And then you've got your interaction terms here. So with like N insertions of a field and the momentum conservation constraint, which is given by the product of this momentum in SU2. And then the main point is that you take this action and you look at it and then you compare it to what I wrote for the two-dimensional group field theory. And you see it's the same kind of field and the same kind of momentum conservation. And the only thing that's different is that here you can have a non-trivial propagator and here the propagator is trivial. So you can see that as some non-commutative field theory on SU2, I mean, the same kind, but with a trivial dynamics. Okay, so you already see that there should be some link there. But of course, this is two-dimensional group field theory, and that was effective actions I got working in three dimensions. So I should actually start with the group field theory in 3D and see how you can get back this type of action there. Clack, clack. So the main tool that we're going to use is some kind of definitions of 2D variation of your group field. So basically, you take your action for 3D group field theory. It is a field which depends on three group elements, and I will define 2D variations taking an ansatz of a field which doesn't depend on one group element. So here I remove G2 and I took a field which only depends on G1 and G3. And because of gauge invariance, it only depends on these combinations of these group elements. So if you take that and you put it in this 3D group field theory, then you see that somehow you just recover a two-dimensional group field theory. The only difference with what I wrote before is that in 2D group field theory, I had taken a cubic interaction term, and here you get a quartic interaction term simply because you had 4 field insertions. And so basically here, you're generating 2D surfaces by gluing squares together. But it's still 2D cellular, I mean, 2D triangulations. Well, quadrilations, I don't know how to say. But basically, 2D, two-dimensional surfaces. So, but here, once again, I still have a trivial propagator. So I'm going to do something slightly better. What I'm going to look, it's I'm going to look for classical solution to this three-dimensional group field theory. And I'm going to identify a certain class of them, which is actually the only class of solutions we found. How it goes, so it's a function of these three group elements, but actually it's constrained to of these group elements to be equal, G1 and G3, and it still allows non-trivial fluctuation of the other group elements, so G2 here. So somehow you can see them are completely orthogonal to the 2D perturbation that I took here, where I just removed G2, and here everything that's fluctuating is G2. And then every ansatz like that provides a classical solution to the quantum to the group field theory. And what I'm going to look at variations around these classical solutions. And I'm going to define the effective dynamics for these two-dimensional variations by simply taking the actions for the field, the sum of, I mean, the 2D variation plus my classical solution by removing the constant offset given by the action evaluated in my classical solution. And what happens is that actually this is going to give me exactly what I want. So I'm going to get something which only depends on my 2D perturbations, of course. Here I remove the constant term. Since also phi f is a classical solution, I'm not going to have any linear term in my variation. And so the first terms I get is quadratic term. Then I get a cubic term and a quartic term. Then if I look at the quadratic term, I will get some corrections, which actually depends on the function f that I've put here. So I will get some non-trivial function of my group element. Actually, this thing is given by some constant plus the self-convolution of f with itself. So it's very some simple functions. And for example, if you take that f is the character of spin 1 in SU2, you will get exactly the kind of p squared minus m squared that you want here. But basically, you get any kinetic term you want, and then you get some cubic term with a coupling constant which depends in lambda, in square root of lambda, and in the integral of f. But it's there. And then you get your usual quadratic term. So basically, what you've done is that you look at certain variation of your group field around some specific classical solutions. And you found that you get exactly the non-inclusive quantum field theories that you wanted. So basically, what you've done is that you close this diagram that I showed, and you have a direct link between these group field theories and the non-inclusive quantum field theories. At the classical level, I didn't do anything quantum. I just looked at the action, specific ansatz for the field, and it all worked. So now if I look a bit deeper at the action that I wrote here, and I decompose it into SU2 representation, I know I always decompose things into SU2 representations. So before, if I was looking at the two-dimensional group field theory, I told you that it was just matrix models, decoupled matrix models. Now I do the same thing, and what I'm going to see is that this non-trivial kinetic term is going to couple matrices of different sizes. But you still have an action which depends on all these tau of matrices, which is invariant of this non-trivial deformed Poincaré symmetry. So this defines a new family of matrix models. So one of the questions I have in my mind is like, can we use like standard matrix models techniques to solve this family of matrix models? And because that would actually help to understand, to get results on these non-quantitative quantum field theories, which are actually non-trivial, and more deeply, some insight into how to solve group field theories in general. So just to summarize what happened is that so we identified a classical phase of this three-dimensional group field theory, which is exactly this quantum field theory, which describes the effective dynamics of matter field coupled to the three-dimensional quantum geometry. And we did that by looking at this two-dimensional group field variation around non-trivial classical solutions. So when you think about it, you realize that what you did is that you started with a model of pure gravity, and you just found some phases of it which is matter. So it looks a bit surprising in some sense. But when you think about it, then group field theories, it's a sum on all possible triangulations. So it's a sum of all possible geometries and topologies. And what happens is that matter fields or matter particles are just represented by some non-trivial topological and geometrical configurations. So it was there. Like, if I had fixed the topology, I wouldn't see it. But now, these non-trivial classical solutions, somehow, that I chose, they define some non-trivial geometrical background when you can have topological fluctuations which correspond to exactly these matter fields. So said like that, it looks complicated. But said like, oh, I just look at classical solutions and variations, it's much simpler. So that's actually the things that we're going to do in four dimensions. We're not going to couple matter, particles as topological defect to your theory. Just going to start directly with a group field theory, look at variation, and find this non-commutative quantum field theory, which describes the effective dynamics of matter. So what we do is that we start with a group field theory for the topological BF theory with a gauge group SO41. So this is the BF theory which is relevant to the approach by Fredel and Sarodubtsev, which is based on the Magdoval-Mansour reaction. So that's exactly the case where I said there was no spin-form model that yet existed. But that's the interesting one for us. But for a moment, we're only looking for the topological BF case. So no gravity, but just the free theory around which we are expanding. Then you can write these non-commutative field theories, doubly special relativity kind of field theories, which are based on a kappa deformed Poincaré group. You can write them in terms of a momentum space, which is curved, which is a group which is called AN-free. We don't really need to see what's AN-free in details, but what's important is that it is a subgroup of SO41. And then what you do is that you look at these classical solutions of the group field theory. You can find the same kind of solutions that we had before. I call them flat because somehow it identifies some of the group elements. And then you study two-dimensional variations which are localized on that subgroup around them. And then you found exactly the non-commutative quantum field theories corresponding to doubly special relativity by doing that. So you find DSR as a phase, a specific classical phase of a four-dimensional group field theory. So that's a big result that we got. To do it explicitly, it's pretty technical. There's a lot of regularization things because this group is non-compact, but it all works well. Whoever wants to see it, just ask me later. So the questions that are left in there, always I looked at 2D variations. So what are the meaning of like 3D variations or any variation of the field? And that's a question I don't know the answer to. There's hints that if you look at 3D variations, instead of having particles, you would have strings, but that's very speculative. Then there's this thing that I localize on that subgroup by hand. So can I have some kind of more dynamical localization? So either by finding some classical solutions which directly localize on it. Whatever we tried, we didn't manage to do that. So we think that this kind of dynamical localization would actually come by actually not taking the topological BF theory, but a the group field theory for something non-topological, which doesn't correspond to topological BF theory, but correspond more to gravity. So this is something we hope that it will work later, but using spin form models for real 4D gravity. So basically, this whole game, I mean, what does it tell us? That you can, with these different lessons, we can draw from that. The first one is that this group thing that we've put in group field theory, which actually correspond to the holonomies in spin form, so loop gravity, they're really the momentum representation here. And you always reconstruct the space-time or the coordinate space by taking the dual, the Fourier transform of that space. So that's an important point to keep later. Not to see the group manifold as the configuration space, but just as a momentum space. Then there's another lesson, which is actually not so nice. Is that so? I was really happy to see the relation between group field theories and non-commutative field theories, because it's a way to derive these non-commutative field theories, so experimental predictions from spin forms and group field theories. But it's actually also very bad, because you will encounter the same problems with group field theories as there are with non-commutative field theories. So some non-commutativity. So it's always hard to quantize when you've got non-commutativity. You will have some braiding and things like that. So you will have the same problems. Or if I'm very optimistic, I would actually say the reverse, that what I know how to do very simply with group field theories might help to solve the problems in quantizing non-commutative field theories. No, it's, hope so. So the other lesson is that in these group field theories for BF theory or gravity, there's already matter. But up to now, I only showed you scalar matter. So the next question, like, can we get like gauge fields and fermions and like all the usual matter? And if it works, it would be great. The other thing is that I said that these effective non-commutative field theories, or even the two-dimensional group field theory, were invariant for some Poincaré invariants, some deformed Poincaré invariants. Actually, you can show that it's not some only symmetry of a specific 2D variation, 2D phase, but some symmetry of a global action. So really, by saying that you've got some quantum deform group symmetry for the group field theory really means that this group field theory can be seen, should be seen as a non-commutative field theory. And all that is basically, for a moment, at the classical level in group field theories. So as I said before, the spin form amplitudes Feynman diagrams of your group field theory. So that's something that's happening at the quantum level. So it's, when you do that, you're already thinking of quantizing and looking at the path integral for group field theories. But all this, I said, it's just at the classical level for group field theories. Symmetries, classical solutions. So that's, we need to say that there's already a lot of things to understand at this classical level for group field theories. But since it is some kind of quantization, these group field theories are some kind of second quantization of the spin forms. It's classical group field theory is already some quantum effects in gravity. So classical group field theory is quantum gravity. So that's why there's so much to see in there. So I would like to conclude by saying what we could try to do. I mean, I told you about the different results we got, and I'd like to tell you just quickly about the things where, what we could do from there. So some technical issue is that I used some specific solution to the four-dimensional group field theories, which I called flat. But one thing which would be nice was, would be classifying this classical solution, which basically correspond to classifying the background, the space-time background to which we correspond to. And it would be nice to understand the vacuum and things like that. I mean, this kind of issue for spin forms. Or for example, like, can we use this coherent detwiners to get some kind of semi-classical background for the 4D group field theories? Then, as I mentioned just now, there's this other issue of the symmetries of the group field theory at the classical level. Well, actually, quantum symmetries under which the group field theory is invariant. So in 3D, we saw that this quantum deformed Poincaré. But in general, we should be able to see what is the generic, what is the full symmetry of these theories and to see all possible effective non-commutativity, I mean, quantum groups that you can get for the dynamics of matter. Because here, I showed there's a way to get this kappa deform Poincaré group, but maybe there's different deformations which appear. And then basically, what I'm really happy in that work is that this kind of like allows to get some triangle of interaction between group field theory, non-commutative field theory, and matrix models. And group field theory, we don't know so much yet about it, but we will soon. But matrix models are well studied, and non-commutative field theories are well studied too. So there's many things we could do. We could study GFT and non-commutative field theory correlations using results from matrix models. Matrix models are integrable, so we have many results on that, and so it could really help understanding the structure of these theories. It would, since they're integrable, we could also get integrable structures in the group field theories, and that would be very helpful to understand the renormalization of these group field theories. And this renormalization is basically a group of group theory will define how you coarse grain models, spin four models, and so we will help understanding the semi-classical and continuum limit of these theories. And that's basically some interesting project for the future. So that's it.
Time for a few questions. Any of the SAG students have questions? Nope, then open the floor to questions from John.
This is quite an impressive amount of work. As a physicist, I have to ask a possibly simple-minded question. How and when can I decide if you have a correct quantum gravity theory? You don't, there are no quantum gravity data. So, for example, can you derive the standard propagator for graviton in a continuum four-dimensional Minkowski space?
That's the thing we'd like to do, for sure. But since for a moment, as I talked earlier about correlations on one for simplex, there's at least two things that you need to solve. You need to solve the coarse graining of spin forms, or renormalization, how to put many of these four simplexes together, and the semi-classical limit problem, and how to write physical semi-classical states on the boundary. So. Hopefully we'll manage to do that, but for the moment we don't have that yet, but hopefully it will work. Once we have that, we can actually compute some kind of graviton propagator for real and check whether it's the right one. But still some work to do.
So the issue arises, how do you decide that you have a quantum gravity theory? Can you? From your spin form.
Well, there's many hints that the thing should work. I mean, the relation with Ricci calculus and all that. So it gives hope that it should work. But then there's still all the work to do to check it. I agree.
One thing to
okay. If not, let's thank Etra again.